From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois' state government and politics.
Governor J.B. Pritzker signs Illinois' new congressional district map into law. These new political boundaries, drawn by Democrats, eliminate districts where a majority of voters voted Republican. Pritzker says the maps reflect Illinois' diversity and preserved minority representation. Change Illinois is among those groups criticizing the new map. The nonprofit says, quote, "Never before have Illinoisans seen such a brazen show of how corrosive politician-led redistricting can be for voters and communities, putting partisan self-interests above the needs of people in communities across the state."
With more people traveling and gathering with family from all parts of the country comes the joys associated with the holidays and being together. It also brings with it COVID concerns.
Right now, what we're seeing predominantly is that first part of the rise, or what we fear is going to be that first part of the rise for general admissions. And certainly our main concern is, does this mean that we're going to progress into a full surge again where our ICU becomes overrun?
Well, yes, we are still in a pandemic, and COVID cases have been going in the wrong direction. We'll talk about that here on State Week. And also, Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed off on a new congressional district map for the state of Illinois. While Illinois will lose a seat in Congress, Democrats are hoping to gain from the new political boundaries. We'll talk about all of that coming up. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Charlie Wheeler is off this week. But with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House Editor. And joining us today, Peter Hancock with Capital News Illinois. And Peter, it's always good to have you on with us.
Thanks, Sean. Good to be here.
Well, Hannah, I mentioned the governor signed this new congressional district map into law. This was put together by Democrats. I guess it wasn't really a shock that he would sign it. He didn't make a big fuss out of it either. This has been getting quite a bit of controversy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he has not done any sort of signing ceremony for the other versions of the maps that he signed either. But he, you know, obviously not unexpected that the Democratic governor would sign the maps that Democrats drew and gave to him to sign. But, you know, unlike the legislative maps, which, you know, we're going to talk about a little bit later, this one, you know, I've been talking to some folks and it's really not expected that this is going to get any sort of big lawsuit play. I mean, you know, someone might follow suit, but it'll be kind of a half-hearted effort compared to you know, obviously what the fight that's been going on over the legislative maps, you know, those it's a lot fewer seats. Obviously there are, and instead of the 18 that we've had over the last decade, we will, you know, we're again being cut down to 17. 14 of those districts are expected to be safe-ish for Democrats. Of course, that doesn't mean that it's an automatic home run for them, and then leaving three expected for Republicans. But there's just, you know, with it being fewer seats spread over a lot more territory, there's just a lot fewer Voting Rights Act claims that can be made that are going to be viable, but we'll see what happens.
As Anna mentioned there, Peter, the fact that, of course, the court challenges are going on for the legislative district maps. Those are state house and Senate districts. But what are some of the concerns with this one that have been raised?
Well, I talked with political science professor Brian Gaines at UIUC, who said, you know, if you just look at the map, it's the kind of map you would draw if there was a rule against having compact districts. There's one odd C-shaped district that starts up in Rockford and wraps around through the Quad Cities and then curls over to Bloomington. There's a Central Illinois district that starts south of the Metro East area, wraps around the city of Champaign, and then goes back over east to an area north of the Metro East area. I mean, it's a very, very odd district. And we suspect, and I'm sure it's no secret, that the DCCC in Washington, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, had quite a hand in drawing the maps, because they know full well that Democrats are expected to lose seats in 2022 And states like Texas and Florida will be gerrymandering their districts to cut Democrats out. So they just thought, you know, this is a way of balancing it out and maybe mitigating the losses Democrats take next year.
Yeah, Peter, what's the likelihood that a court would say, because we've had some crazy looking districts in the past, they've been allowed to go ahead and stay in place. So what's the likelihood that we're going to see any changes to this?
Yeah, I don't know. I have not heard of any lawsuits in the making just yet. It's not to say there won't be any. Usually plaintiffs wait until after a set of maps is signed into law before filing a suit. Congressional maps are harder to challenge. The U.S. Supreme Court has basically said partisan gerrymandering is okay. You know, I mean, everybody knows that the majority party in any given state is going to draw districts to their advantage, and there's not much you can do about that. So, yeah, challenging federal maps, I think, is harder than challenging state maps.
And Hannah, the Congress, Republican Congress people who have either are going to run again, or in some cases, we look at Adam Kinzinger, for example, have already made their decision. They're not going to seek office. So to some extent, there's no real incumbents here, or not many at least, that are waiting for any type of action. It seems like everybody's starting to move forward under the understanding that this is what it's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, the only real answer we're still waiting on is whether or not Rodney Davis wants to, you know, remain in Congress. I think, you know, for the most part, most folks you talk to say it makes way more sense for Rodney Davis to remain in Congress for a whole host of reasons. First of all, you know, he's getting to the point in his career where he can start having some real influence, especially if the GOP does take back the House. And, you know, his voting record, if he ran, as some speculated, if he tried to run against J.B. Pritzker for governor, his voting record's just too conservative for, you know, a lot of Illinois voters, you know, for that to make sense, for that to be a gamble that would make sense for him. And so, you know, I Rodney had been saying, you know, I'll wait to make any sort of announcement until after, you know, things are settled. And so very soon we're going to hear the most likely, not very surprising news that he's going to remain in Congress, because of course, for a while there was a sense that would Rodney be kind of redistricted out of his own district. And instead the district was, you know, the one that Peter was describing a couple minutes ago. It snakes down from Rockford and it covers a lot of the state that, you know, Rodney Davis has not necessarily covered before, but, you know, I think his vast experience in office and also, you know, serving as chief of staff and for other congresspeople throughout his career will serve him just fine in getting reelected to in this new territory.
And Davis's decision will impact another member of Congress, a sitting member of Congress, freshman Mary Miller. She has to decide what she's going to do.
Oh, sure. I mean, so she and Mike Bost had, you know, were districted in together because, you know, you don't technically have to live in the district that you would serve, at least for, you know, representing in Congress. You know, she could decide to, you know, challenge either of them. But I feel like either way, you know, it's going to be a tough election for her. It'd be very interesting to see what her calculation is. Of course, she is you know, made a lot of waves in her first year in Congress, starting with her comments the day before the Capitol insurrection in D.C. on January 5th. She was at a rally of, you know, I think like Concerned Mothers for America or something like that. And she said, you know, Hitler was right about one thing. You have to, you know, win the hearts and minds of children. And of course, she was roundly criticized and, you know, denounced by a whole host of groups, including some in her own party. And so she's had very interesting first year in Congress. But, you know, speaking of members who are not going to, you know, challenge folks in not their districts, that we've spoken before about how, you know, the day after Democrats passed the congressional map in Springfield, you know, Adam Kinzinger, of course, said he was going to not run, which would have forced him to run against Darren LaHood, a much more conservative member of Congress, a more pro-Trump wing. Well, Kinzinger has criticized that wing of his party, but also, of course, Marie Newman, another freshman, progressive. She felt as if she was, given the short end of the stick from the maps because some of her territory was given to make a second Latino influenced district in Illinois, given the growth of the Latino population. That was obviously not unexpected, but I think it was, she felt jilted. And so she is going to instead run against Sean Casten, who is in his second term serving as a Democrat in Illinois' 6th congressional district. And so that will be very interesting primary matchup to watch.
Okay. You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Hannah Meisel and also Peter Hancock from Capital News Illinois. Peter, let's turn to the legislative district maps, the state legislative district maps. Those include the House and Senate districts. It seems like we've been talking about this thing for so long now, and it seems a long time ago that these were actually signed into law. But that's not a done deal yet because, again, the courts are weighing in.
That's right. There are three simultaneous lawsuits challenging those maps. And it seems like a long time because this is actually the second set of maps that lawmakers passed. They passed one in the spring, basically just to meet that constitutional June 30th deadline to prevent it from going to a bipartisan commission and potentially a coin toss. Then they came back in late August after the census numbers, which had been delayed, were finally released. They passed these maps. So we have three sets of lawsuits, one by the Republican leadership, Senator Dan McConkie and Representative Jim Durkin, along with the Illinois State Republican Party. There's another one by a Latino advocacy group, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, or MALDEF. And then a third one concentrating on the East St. Louis area, with the NAACP, both the East St. Louis chapter and the Illinois state chapter, along with a group called the United Congress for Community and Religious Organizations, or UCRO. So a three-judge panel in Chicago is going to hear these starting on December 7th. They'll be heard simultaneously. So far, each set of plaintiffs has submitted a proposed map that would change. They're only focusing on the Chicago area, where the plaintiffs say there should be more Hispanic influence districts, and on the Metro East area, where they say the Black voting population was broken up specifically to help some sitting white Democratic incumbents.
Well, I guess I will ask a similar question as before when it came to congressional district maps. On this set of this map here, when we're looking at the challenges that are out there, do they have a better shot in this sense of at least getting some type of change added to this map?
I think there is a chance that the court will make some change. MALDEF is arguing for an increase up to about, I think, 7 or 8 Latino districts in the Chicago area. The Republicans are arguing for as many as 11. That might be considered, in gerrymandering cases, they use the words packing and cracking. When you put large numbers of minority voters into a small number of districts, that's called packing. When you break them up so that they don't have influence in any district, that's called cracking. It would be to the Republicans' advantage to put as many Hispanic people as possible into Hispanic influence districts, because that would then ease pressure on Republican candidates in other districts. And I think they're also doing the same thing in the Metro East area. The one representative there, Democrat Katie Stewart, I think is from Edwardsville, won her race by a very narrow margin last time around. And so the feeling was that legislative Democrats were trying to protect her. The plaintiffs, two sets of plaintiffs, are saying that unfairly broke up Democratic or African-American voting blocks in the East St. Louis area.
And Peter, real quick, the fact that this is going before a judge, it's December 7th, of course, we have the holiday period coming up. Is there any chance that anything here could delay the candidate filing period, for example, anything like that?
Well, the court has been very conscious about that. Just recently, the legislative defendants, in this case, it's House Speaker Chris Welch and Senate President Don Harmon, asked for an extension of time to reply to the maps that the plaintiffs submitted. And the judges wrote that they would give them a couple of days, but that was going to be it because candidates have to start circulating petitions in about mid-January, and they have to know what district they're living in. Looks like the court is trying to keep this train running on time so that they have maps and even have it in time to allow one party or another to appeal the decision if they choose to.
And Hannah, when it comes to redistricting, this is something that comes up every 10 years, but it's not something that the public pays a lot of attention to, maybe for various reasons. First and foremost, it's kind of a behind-the-scenes process. I know there were some hearings held by Democrats, but we really didn't even get to see what the Democrats were proposing until just right before they were voted on. And something I saw in one of in Peter's article that he put out this week, quoting the advocacy group Change Illinois, and the comment was that the new maps were designed to produce predetermined winners and losers in nearly all 17 congressional districts. You can make the same argument in a lot of the legislative districts as well. People oftentimes make the argument that, you know, I don't have an opponent that I could vote for in this district against the incumbent, or maybe it's a Democratic district, I don't have a Republican who's even running. A lot of that comes from this redistricting process. It's not necessarily helping democracy in the state of Illinois, is it?
I mean, it's not in the state of Illinois, not any other state who does it, you know, in a different way. I mean, listen, if we wanted to have a better democracy, you know, maybe the Supreme Court could have weighed in differently on redistricting in the couple of key cases that came before the body in the last decade or so. But, you know, they didn't want to weigh in. Of course, the court is petrified of looking political. But, you know, I feel like, you know, for the last however many years, like, buddy, you're already there. I don't really know, you know, how you could look less political. The court could have done something. And so, you know, but now you have all of these states and, you know, the NCSL, which is the National Conference of State Legislatures, put out this infographic last week that showed there's only one legislature in the entire country that has, you know, a split, representation in their House and Senate, and that is Minnesota. You know, the rest, you see unilateral control. And in a lot of those states, too, like Illinois, you have a governor who is the same party as the legislature. And you have that in a lot of red states, too. It's, you know, complete Republican control. And so, you know, these things are not good for democracy, but we are, you know, I feel like a lot of folks who do politics for a living, and, you know, even the folks who do things like voting rights, they don't necessarily have time to think about, you know, how things could be, especially at a time like this in a redistricting year when things have to be done by certain deadlines. You know, they work in the system as it is. And, you know, you have to applaud the groups and the people who want to make us better by reforming the process. But it's, you know, you can't just snap your fingers. You know, President Obama's wish that he articulated when he visited the legislature, that day in February 2016, and he called for, you know, a better politics. And he laid out this, you know, whole speech. And in it, he, you know, spoke against gerrymandering. But what is left out often when Republicans say, hey, Democrat, look at this. Remember your guy? Remember he came here? Obama was not arguing for, you know, disarmament. I mean, you would have to have every state stop gerrymandering, you know, in order to accomplish this perfectly. It would require a nationwide solution, which, you know, there is a bill in Congress that would address this, but guess where that's going? Probably not very far.
Well, let's turn our attention to COVID-19. As I mentioned at the start of the show, we're still in a pandemic, although a lot of places I've been to recently, it doesn't appear that way. We have a mask mandate still in effect, but again, a lot of people don't seem to be following that. And there are concerns still, even though we saw a nice dip in cases and hospitalizations after that big Delta run-up that we saw near the end of the summer. But now cases are starting to happen again. And Hannah, give us kind of an update on where we stand right now when it comes to COVID-19.
Yeah, we are up, you know, kind of 50%, a little bit more on new COVID hospitalizations than we were at the low point, you know, several weeks ago. And same with the number of new COVID cases, though I will say we are doing more COVID testing than ever before. So, you know, just relying on pure case numbers, I think, is a little bit irresponsible. But we are definitely seeing, you know, another uptick, and it is concerning. It is very frustrating. You know, the governor, I think he is definitely regretting his words now. You know, I feel like it was sometime in mid-October, he said he would want to see mask mandates removed by the holidays. Obviously, that is not happening, although Illinois is apparently one of only six states that still does have some sort of statewide mask mandate. You know, we're seeing boosters being rolled out. You know, more than, I think, like 1.5 million Illinoisans have gotten their booster shots. And we're also on like our second week of vaccinating kids ages 5 through 11. But unfortunately, it looks like we're in for another sort of winter of COVID, another slog. We're not seeing, though, caseloads and hospitalizations that are, you know, anywhere near the level, at least not yet, of states like Michigan or Colorado, which are, you know, I've seen some reports about hospital bed shortages, you know, where Southern Illinois was at in about August. Hopefully we're not going in that direction, but I, you know, I can't say. No one can say. I think the thing that's been proven in the last 20 so odd months is that no one knows where this is going. There's always another horrible surprise.
Yeah, and Peter, certainly the governor has come out strong in favor of people getting vaccinated, of course, the boosters as well. One of those groups that he had targeted early and said, you got to get the vaccine was AFSCME. And while a few other unions have acquiesced to the governor, that is still one that I believe there's still some back and forth going on, negotiations. Do we know where that stands at this point?
It just what they tell us. I think the concern among the union is not about the wisdom of getting vaccinated, but about what happens to employees who decide not to get vaccinated. They think these are things that have to be negotiated. And they're kind of taking a pretty strong position on that. And just to kind of follow up on what Hannah was saying, you know, we saw this last year too. The weather's colder outside. People are spending more time indoors where transmission is easier. And the vaccine rate has kind of plateaued. Just full disclosure, I will count myself as among the 1.5 million people who just went and got a booster shot, along with a flu shot. But there's still a large portion of, or a sizable portion of the population out there that is not vaccinated and by all appearances will not get vaccinated. And as long as you have that combined with the other factors, we're going to keep seeing these cycles of surges and valleys until, you know, whatever it takes for this pandemic to go away.
And Peter, last year there was a lot of concern going into the holidays. We didn't really see the bump, I guess, from of cases and hospitalizations that we thought we might. But I felt like last year, like I mentioned earlier, that people were following the masking guidance a lot more than they are now. It seems like people are tired of wearing a mask. I understand that. And so not only could you see cases of COVID, but you could also see more cases of the flu if people are getting out, getting together more and not protecting themselves.
Yeah, I think you're right there. People were following the mask protocols, pretty well last year. In the places around Springfield where I go, I think they still are, certainly in the grocery store and other places I go to. I don't, go everywhere in town. I think last year, though, there was a lot less holiday travel than there usually is. They're expecting a big uptick in that this year because a lot of people are vaccinated and, people are just tired of being isolated. Should be noted, though, this is happening at the same time some countries in Europe are reinstituting lockdowns. So it's not just the United States. It's a global condition. And from what we can tell right now, it's not going away.
All right. Well, we'll continue to watch that. It's time now for our notes from the field. And Hannah, let's go to you.
Sure. Longtime Democratic state legislator John DiMicco from Chicago's Northwest Side resigned a couple Fridays ago. Not unexpected. He's, like I said, had a long career and, part of kind of a legacy family in politics. Finally, after a couple weeks, the 39th Ward Democrats, which really held all the power in the appointment process, it really just matters who that committeeman is, who happens to be State Senator Ram Villavallam, picked Michael Kelly to replace John DiMicco. And Michael Kelly, a friend of John DiMicco's, firefighter, and he was endorsed by a ton of trade unions.
Okay. And Peter.
Yeah. Earlier this week, it didn't get a whole lot of coverage, but a couple of House Republicans came out with a proposal for starting off a temporary refundable tax credit to help ease the impact of inflation. And I guess this is kind of a generational thing. I remember Avery Bourne, a Republican, one of the younger members of the General Assembly, saying inflation now is the worst it's ever been in her lifetime. For those of us who are old enough to remember the Ford and Carter administrations and double-digit inflation, the 5 or 6% inflation rate we're seeing right now is not shocking, but it is concerning. And so they thought for people up to certain income limits, I think it's $200 for individuals, maybe $400 for couples and heads of household, one-time refundable tax credit would help ease some of the impact on that. We haven't really heard Democrats jump on board with that, but it's really, something that could be considered, especially given all of the federal money that is flowing into the state, as well as the improved revenue estimates that state officials came out with recently. There may be money to pay for something like that.
All right, that's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Hannah Meisel and Peter Hancock of Capital News Illinois. Get a podcast of our show through the NPR One app or iTunes and also at nprillinois.org. Join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.